Okay, I guess I have to sit down here and rather stay. Anyway, okay, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to my talk on machine learning and in science and engineering. My name is Gunnar Rätsch, and I'm from the Max Planck Institute in Tübingen, from the Friedrich Miescher Laboratory. I got my PhD 2001 in computer science on machine learning. I mainly worked on new algorithms for machine learning, like boosting and support vector machines. I'm going to talk about that, and many applications. So, and now I've started a new lab in Tübingen, the Friedrich Miescher Laboratory, and I'm considering computational biology there. But I'm talking about many other applications as well. Okay, so I'll start with some motivating examples. And after that, give some background on machine learning. Then talk about boosting and support vector machines. And finally, give some applications. I have many of them, and most likely I'll go over time or have to stop earlier, but let's see. The rationale behind this talk and maybe machine learning in general is that we would like to let the computers learn to automate processes and to understand highly complex data, like genomic data or general sequence data. Okay, let's start with one example you all know is like the problem of spam classification. So you have like two emails, one is a spam email and the other one is some announcement in a connections list email, some position announcement. So the goal is that we would like to classify the emails into spam and non-spam. How can we do that? We have already quite a few emails received, like a lot of spam emails and a lot of usual emails. And somehow we would like to instruct the computer to learn about our spam emails and our normal emails. So somehow we have training data which we can exploit. We have to analyze what is a spam email, what is a non-spam email, and then we can generate a rule which can classify. And after that, we can apply the new classifier to classify new emails. So there are always two steps. One is a training step, and one is the testing or application step. Another example is in drug discovery. So this is in pharmaceutics. One would like to find a new drug which, for instance, has a certain function. For instance, it binds to a certain target protein, like this one here. So one usually starts off with many compounds, like millions of them, and somehow would like to find those compounds which actually bind to this target protein. And how this is done is, so usually the chemist looks at some representation of these molecules, like this one here, and then the chemist decides, okay, this compound might actually bind to the protein and another one might not bind to the protein. Then these compounds go to the lab, they test whether they actually bind, and this is like a cycle, so this is a drug design cycle. One tests a few compounds and then the chemist again looks at the data and redecides what is good and what is bad. And here we can use machine learning to actually maybe not replace but to assist the chemist to classify. Okay. And again, here we have some compounds where we already know they are labeled positive and some are labeled negative, and many other compounds which are unlabeled. So again, we have this training test setting. This is important. Third example is the example of face detection. Here we can train a classifier which can try to classify small patches of an image and detect whether there is a face or not. And after that, one can scan the whole image, like every single patch in the image, and decide whether there is a face present or not. And I show you some more examples on that. Okay, a bit more formally, supervised machine learning, and that is what I'm considering here, in particular classification, there we have n training examples with a label attached. So usually the training examples are some objects and they have some description. So let's say in form of a vector x1 to xn, and they have a label attached like plus or minus 1, for instance. For classification, the plus class would be a face and the minus class would be a non-face, for instance, or spam, non-spam, right? And the task is then to analyze this training data and learn a function which can map from the description of the object to the label plus minus 1. And important is that it works perfectly well on unseen examples. So then we apply this f of x. So there are some assumptions one has to make. So these examples are generated from some underlying statistical process. And there has to be some relationship between the features and the labels. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to predict from the features to the label. And furthermore, there's the assumption that the unseen examples are generated from the same or from a similar statistical process as the training data. So we somehow think of drawing randomly some training data from some process. We observe n values from that. And then later we would like to generalize to other other examples. Okay, some simple example. Let's say we would like to classify apples into natural apples versus plastic apples. So the natural apple, for instance, gets a label plus one, and the plastic apple gets a negative label. So we have our training data. Okay, there is some unknown target function which we would like to find. So y equals f of x. These apples randomly come in and we have to classify them. For instance, this one here is a random apple and we don't know the label. And the objective is, given the x, we have to predict the y. So if everything would be known, like the whole probability distribution and everything, so then this problem would be easy. But unfortunately, the only thing we know is really the apples, like these four apples, maybe a few more. Okay, so maybe this is the most complicated slide, so I try to explain it easily. So the idea is that when we try to learn to classify something, one has to start off with some hypothesis set. So this is like the set of functions where we can choose our hypothesis from. So essentially, for instance, that could be, I don't know, I give examples later. So this is like all different functions which could classify apples. Okay, so they map from some, for instance, a d-dimensional vector space to plus minus 1. And then we have some loss function. That could be, for instance, in the case of apples, when we make a misprediction, then this is 1, otherwise it's 0. Okay? And the ultimate goal is that we would like to minimize the true, that means the expected loss, that is the called the generalization error. So we would like to find the function in this function space that minimizes like the future loss. The problem, of course, is that we only have like the data sample available, our training data, and all is essentially unknown. And the only thing what we can do is we can find the function which minimizes the so-called empirical loss. So that is like the loss on our training examples. Okay, so like when we have 100 apples, 50 of one class, 50 of another class, this is our training set, then we would like to find a function that classifies all apples correctly, if there is one, out of this set of different functions. Okay, but it's important that the set of functions is fixed beforehand. So it can't be like any function.
Excuse me.
Yeah?
What is the big E?
The big E is the indicator function. So that is one if... That's the expectation over the probability distribution over all different x's with all different y's. So that means all apples with labels. So that is like the loss of all possible apples.
And the big L is a linear function, or the function h?
It depends on the loss function. So it can be, yes.
So I mean, L is a number if it is applied to
L is a number, right. But it's not necessarily linear in H.
Oh, a function.
Yeah, it's a function of H. Yes, that's right. Okay, so let's get back to our apples. So we have these six apples of one class, six apples of another class. First, they're just objects. We need to have some properties about these apples in order to classify them. And I came up with two different properties, so I call them features. The first feature is how red the apple is, so like on this axis, and then how light the apple is. Okay, so for instance, this apple here is not particularly red, but it's pretty heavy. This one here is also not red, but it's not so heavy. Okay, so now you can imagine classifying these apples, like putting a line through here. Everything would be on one side, and all the other apples would be on the other side. Okay, now let's consider one very simple hypothesis class. This would be the class of axis parallel cuts. So that would mean like lines like cutting here or cutting here. So this is our hypothesis set. Like this one here. This classifies all apples in one class and all the other apples in the other class. However, it makes some mistakes. This one is an error and this is another error. Okay. But there are many other cuts maybe. So and this builds up our hypothesis class. Okay, now I'm going to describe you one algorithm. It's called AdaBoost. It has been developed by Freund Shapir in 96. And the idea is that one can use many simple hypotheses or rules of thumb. You could, for instance, come up with many other properties of the apple. For instance, the size of the leaf or the color of the leaf and so on, right? So and all of those features or all of these rules of thumb wouldn't be perfect, but they would help classifying. And the idea of AdaBoost is to combine those rules of thumb and to increase the accuracy. So the problem, of course, is how can we generate different hypotheses, how can we select them, and how can we actually combine them after that. And there's one method, AdaBoost, where one has a distribution on the examples. So we have n training examples, and then one has a weight attached to each example. And these weights are updated in each iteration. So in the in the second step, one finds the hypothesis which has the smallest weighted training error, okay? And then the weights are changed. I explain that in more detail. The weights are changed and one iterates this. So one gets like a set of different hypotheses and one also computes like these alpha j, the hypothesis coefficients. So in the end, we have a linear combination. Okay, let's do that with our apples. Okay, this is our first hypothesis. It's very simple. It makes some mistakes. Like first mistake here, and the other mistake is here. So the idea of boosting is now that we increase the weight of those examples which are misclassified. Okay, so they're like the size of the apple is like proportional to the weight. So I increased the size of this apple and this apple. Now we are looking for a new hypothesis. We start from you and ask our base hypothesis class what is the best hypothesis now. And it turns out this is the best one. Okay? Again, this apple and this apple is misclassified, so we increase the weight for those and decrease the weight for all others. Okay? So we can do this several times. There's another hypothesis now here, and a fourth hypothesis here, and in the end, we linearly combine them. So that's a linear combination, and if you now draw the line where the linear combination is exactly zero, right? So on one side is minus one, like one negative, on the other side is positive, then it's this line. And it classifies all apples correctly. So there's some nice properties about boosting. Usually one does not need many iterations to achieve a solution like this. So to classify all points correctly, usually just log n. N is the number of training examples iteration. Okay, so that's the algorithm. I don't want to go over it. It's just doing what I said. So there's some. Okay, so one can use AdaBoost with, for instance, decision stumps, these axis parallel cuts, or decision trees, or neural networks, what you like. You can also have your heuristic set of rules, so like these size of the leaves and stuff. And that works pretty well with boosting. So there's some web page, boosting.org, maintained by me. There you find a lot of references, like probably 200 papers just about boosting. And also I would like to mention there's a summer school going on every year. Next time in Australia in February, I think, the Machine Learning Summer School, and there are two proceedings books from these summer schools, and they are like introductory articles about machine learning, and one is edited by me. So, okay, I put all the references in the accompanying paper in the proceedings here, so you find the references there. Are there questions for that? So I'm going to the next part. Okay. Okay, let's start from the beginning. Now it's another algorithm, another explanation. Okay, we start off again with some data points, our objects, which are somehow represented in a two-dimensional space in this case. And now we consider linear hyperplanes for separating these points. So, for instance, here are two hyperplanes, both separating the set of points. The question is, which of these hyperplanes should we prefer? So both actually classify all points correctly. And there's one important result from statistical learning theory, which tells us that we should prefer the hyperplane which has the largest margin. What is a margin? The margin is like the distance of the point to the hyperplane. So we try to find the hyperplane, okay, so the hyperplane, this one here, that maximizes the distance to all training points, okay? And there are some theoretical results, I cannot go into detail there, which show that when you have a large margin classification, when you find a hyperplane which has a large margin, they guarantee that on the test set, on the unseen examples, it generalizes well. Okay, so a bit more formally, so we try to find a function, which in this case is just a linear hyperplane, so it's w times x. W is the normal vector of this hyperplane, okay, so it's perpendicular to the hyperplane, such that we maximize a margin, and this is essentially f of x plus, where x plus is a positive example, minus f of x minus, and x minus is a negative example. So for all pairs of positive and negative examples. So this difference should be large, where we keep this w, the norm of w, equal to 1. Okay? So this is an optimization problem and can be solved just using standard techniques. In the end, we get this w, and we compute, and we can classify new points by taking the signum of f of x plus some bias term. It turns out that the optimal w can be expressed as a linear combination of the examples here. So xn are our training points, and is sum over n alpha n xn. So it turns out that these alpha n's are usually zero, only those points which are closest to the hyperplane, like this one here and this one here, and these two as well, they have non-zero alpha coefficients, and that make support vector machines very efficient, because most of these alpha coefficients are actually zero. So one can very efficiently after that compute the w and also the f of x. Okay, yes? You have to compute this hyperplane. After computing the hyperplane, you get a solution in terms of the alpha. So, okay, so what you could do, let's say you have the hyperplane, then you could simply look which points are closest to the hyperplane. Okay, so there's this margin area, and all the points which are further away than the closest ones have zero alpha, and all the others have non-zero alphas. And those points are called the support vectors, because they are supporting the hyperplane. All the others don't matter in the classification. Okay, so and this is, now I explained you the support vector machine. I got a small demo for that. Let's see. Okay, so what I can do here is, just a second. What I can do here is I can click a few points and like positive points and some negative points, and make it simple. Okay. And then I train the support vector machine. So on my laptop, that's pretty slow, but it's just very inefficiently programmed. So sorry for that. It takes a few seconds. Usually it would take maybe a tenth of a second or something, right? And now we have the hyperplane, is the middle line here. and the other two lines mark the edge of the margin area. Okay, so and this would be a support vector, this one, and this one. Okay, so yeah, and maybe later we can play around a bit more. So then you see a bit more, so get a better intuition. Okay, so now you might say linear classification is not very strong. So what can you do with linear classification? But turns out there's a very powerful trick, and it's called the kernel trick. And I'll explain that here. So first, let's consider again some training data points, these positive points here and negative points here. We try to separate them with a linear hyperplane. That's hardly possible. But if we somehow would allow a nonlinear separation, then this would be very easily possible. And the idea is that we, before we actually do the separation, we first map all the training points to some feature space. So, for instance, this is a two-dimensional space, and let's say this is a three-dimensional space. Okay, so it's a two-dimensional projection of a three-dimensional space. So in this feature space, the data turn out to be separable. Okay, we do a linear separation in this space. Oops. We do a linear separation in this space here, and a linear separation in this space actually means a nonlinear separation in this space. Okay, so what essentially the trick is first to map all the training data points to the feature space, and then do the same support vector algorithm as before. Okay, so what's the trick now? This phi, this mapping phi, can be very complex. For instance, it would be possible to map from a two-dimensional space to a million-dimensional space. So, and the algorithm requires to compute dot products between the training data points. So that would be then a phi of x times some other phi of y or something. So, and now there's the trick that usually the kernel can be computed very efficiently just in terms of the input space. And I'm going to give an example for the in the next slide. Oops. That's here. Okay. So let's say we have a two-dimensional space. We have some data points like those here and the positive points here. And we map these data points to a three-dimensional space. And the transformation is as follows. So the first coordinate is x1 squared. The second coordinate is square root of 2 times x1, x2. And the third coordinate is x2 squared. And in this space, the data looks like this. So now we can actually separate the data just with a linear hyperplane. Okay. Now, the algorithm just works by taking scalar products, like phi of x times phi of x prime. And it turns out that in this particular case, it can be very efficiently computed just by taking the scalar product in the input space, in this space, and just square it. Okay. Okay, so I'm giving you another demo just with a much more complex kernel, so that can essentially classify any almost an arbitrary data points. So in this case, the data is mapped into some infinite dimensional space, so don't worry. And it has essentially e to the minus and then the distance between the two data points, and there's some parameter which controls the smoothness of the decision boundary. So and I show you that here. Okay, clear that. So that's the parameter sigma. Okay, let's put it not too big. And now I do something a bit more nonlinear. Okay. Oops. So we cannot separate this with a linear separation hyperplane. And what we get then is something like that. So now the decision boundary is this one here, and the margin area is again marked by the other two lines. Okay, you have to imagine that in some feature space, this corresponds to a linear classification. Just map back to the input space, to our two-dimensional space, this means something nonlinear. Yeah?
Can you please
Can you please explain the relationship between the mapping from the input space to the feature space and the kernel? You didn't mention it at all. It just stands side by side.
So I thought it's complicated. So essentially the algorithm here, so this support vector algorithm, works only in terms of SCADA products between training points, between any pair of training points like X and X dash. So essentially when you work in the linear input space, right, so then the only thing you need is a computing SCADA product between any pair of points. So it's a big matrix. Okay, so when you now map the data into some, when you now map the data into some feature space, then you need to compute phi of x times phi of x dash, okay? And one simply replaces this scalar product by some kernel function. This is x of k of x and x dash. So this kernel function has to satisfy certain properties I don't want to talk about, but usually it is sufficient just to write down a function like this one here, so this Gaussian kernel, and this implicitly corresponds to a mapping into some feature space, but this mapping I don't need to know necessarily.
And the value of big phi is the vector in the
feature space. Yes, yes. Okay. So this could be like in the case of the Gaussian kernel, that is an infinite dimensional vector. Okay. So when I increase, for instance, the sigma, this smoothness parameter, then we get a smoother decision. So, but it doesn't classify all the points correctly. So when I decrease it, then we get a much less smooth decision boundary. Most likely, this won't generalize well, whereas this one will probably generalize pretty well to new points which I may draw. Okay, so it turns out that there are many other algorithms which can use kernels. Essentially, any linear algorithm which can be expressed in terms of scalar products, and also one can design specific kernels for particular applications. Like I'll speak about briefly about sequence analysis, like when analyzing the human genome. Then one can design specific string kernels, for instance, or I'll talk about digit recognition. So then one needs some specific kernels which use local correlations in the pictures. So, and there are tons of different kernels for different applications. So there's one book, or actually there are several books, but let's take this one. This is written by Bernard Schulkopf and Alexander Smoller. It's appeared in MIT Press and it's called Learning with Kernels, and that's that's maybe 800 pages just about learning with kernels. So, and there's a webpage, kernelmachines.org, where you find a lot of information on kernel machines. So current techniques work particularly well for classification, for instance. So I mainly talked about classification so far. So there we have maybe two classes, or maybe a few classes, but not too many. So those algorithms are theoretically and also algorithmically very well understood. So you have algorithms like the support vector machines, which work with 100,000 or a million examples and can still learn very efficiently. So another problem is, for instance, a regression. So there you have some x, which is only one-dimensional here, and you would like to estimate like some real value. Like you have some data cloud, some data points given here, and then you would like to estimate a function like that, like interpolate between the points or extrapolate if it's a time series. A third problem is the one of novelty detection. You just have a given a cloud of data points, like those here, and some points are outlying, okay, so those here. And you would like to identify those points. For instance, simply by drawing a circle around it, it would solve this problem in these two dimensions. However, in real-world applications, it's usually not sufficient just to look at the data, because it's not two-dimensional, but 100,000-dimensional. And then it's much harder to find those circles around data points. So the bottom line is that machine learning at the moment works very well for relatively simply structured objects like vectors in some vector space with simple properties. So, for instance, the class label is just plus or minus one or some real value. So current research includes classifying complex objects. For instance, an XML page is something which is not very well suited for machine learning techniques at the moment. Other cases are when you have many classes, like millions of classes, but only 1,000 examples. So then it's really hard to learn something. Then there's another case, it's called active learning. So when the learning setup is slightly different from this training test setting. And something I was working on is prediction of complex properties. So the label itself is complex. Okay, so are there questions to the kernel machines part? Okay. So there are actually many applications of that, and I'm going to mention a few of them. But what's the time? I don't know. Okay. Good. So I'll start with some results on handwritten letter or digit recognition, and then essentially apply the same technique to face and object detection in natural scenes. I'll mention a bit more detailed the brain-computer interface that is being developed at Fraunhofer FIRST in Adlershof. I personally was not working on that, so I'm sorry if I'm telling nonsense, but I find it very interesting. I'm working on gene finding and drug discovery. Other people at Fraunhofer FIRST work on intrusion detection systems, but I think I won't have time to talk about that much. And that is an unsupervised problem. And another problem is what I mentioned already, like spam mail classification, is essentially the problem of document classification. At some point, I worked on some non-intrusive load monitoring system for electric appliances. That is an application where you measure like some information at the household main power connection, right? And then you can actually classify which of the devices in the household are switched on and switched off, right? So like the TV is on or the air conditioning system is on. So you don't need like an intrusive measurement in the household. You can classify with high accuracy just by measuring outside. Another project I've been working on is company fraud detection together with KPMG. So important cases are like Enron, and KPMG is very interested in finding out in which companies there's actually going to be fraud. So, and they developed some questionnaires, like evaluating the situation in the company, and then based on these questionnaires and the labels, which we got for maybe 100 cases, we could classify with 95% correctness whether there is going to be fraud in this company. So, like somebody stole money or something like that. So another application is like fake interviewer identification in social studies. So there are big companies like, so there are companies like paying other people to interview like families about their social behavior or some opinions or whatever. And usually these interviewers are lazy bumps and don't want to do the interviews, and they simply fill out the questionnaires by themselves. And there are very efficient methods for actually finding out which interviewers faked their protocols and which not. Very efficient. I just want to mention two other applications a few colleagues of mine worked on. One is some optimized disk caching strategy. It's essentially a combination of several methods like FIFO or least recently used or whatever. So, and on the fly, it optimizes the combination of different disk caching strategies and achieves much better hit rates than the usual caching strategies. And another problem is the disk spin down prediction for mobile computers. So, based on the current usage patterns, does it make sense to shut down the hard disk or not? Okay. So first first part is now some handwritten character recognition. So that is a benchmark data set that is that contains 60,000 training examples and 10,000 test examples, and there are digits like those here. They are 28 by 28 pixels, and you see they are readable but not perfectly readable. There are some cases like this one here is a zero, but sometimes they are much worse cases, and they are pretty hard to classify. So, and one can use, for instance, a support vector machine with polynomial kernel, and I explained a bit this polynomial kernel before. And essentially what this polynomial kernel is doing, it considers all dth order correlations of all 28 times 28 pixels. So it's like 700 something pixels, and it considers, for instance, all 10th order correlations of all different pixels. So this is like millions of different combinations. And in this feature space, the data is very well separated, and one can actually classify this very well with this kernel. And also it's very efficient. The only thing what you need to do in order to compute this kernel is doing, yeah, maybe 700 operations, although it's actually classifying in a million-dimensional space. So so we have some results here. So like the first result, okay, so a usual linear classifier is pretty bad. There's some other method, it's called nearest neighbor method, is also pretty bad. Then the SVM with this simple polynomial kernel is also pretty, is already pretty good, so 1.4%. Then there are certain improvements. One is using boosting, what I explained, it's boosting neural networks. It goes down to 0.7% misclassification error rate. And then there's some extension of support vector machines, which is currently holding the record with 0.456% obtained by DeCoste and Shilkov in 2002. So the same technique can be essentially applied to detecting faces in some natural scenes. So we have a classifier based on some patch. It classifies whether this patch contains a face or a non-face, right? So the problem with these methods is, although they are already pretty fast, one has to search like the whole image for those patches. And there are actually quite a few patches. So you have to look for all different possibilities of putting this patch somewhere. And then you need to classify, does it contain an image, or does it contain a face or not? So in particular, you want to look maybe at different scales, right? So you need to scale down the image because the face might appear in different scales. So just for this image, it would be like 500,000 patches which you need to evaluate. Okay, so support vector classification is fast, but maybe not fast enough to do this in real time. Okay, so there's one technique I briefly describe how to make this fast enough. So the idea is that for easy patches, like this one here, like a patch around here, never looks like an image. So we can be pretty sure that this is not an image. This is not a face. Sorry. The idea is that we train the classifier, but we try to find, let's say, a representation of the classifier which is very fast. So essentially, this classifier is some combination of filters. So the first filter would be this. So it essentially scans the image whether it finds something like this. So, and if it's certainly not looking like this image here, then I reject this area completely from the beginning. And the more difficult the patches become, the more filters I have to apply. Okay, so and that is essentially done in this picture here. So the first filter is run on the whole image, and you see a lot of faces, and essentially only 19% of the patches are left. I think it doesn't look like it, but anyway. So let's go on. We use more filters, 20 filters here, and okay, much fewer images or much fewer patches are actually left. And 30 filters, much less left. And after 70 filters, we have essentially recovered almost all faces. So there are some which I missed. But it's pretty efficient and... there are some faces missing. For instance, this half face here, which is a bit hidden with the hair, that is missing. Okay, so the idea is that the classifiers are already very accurate, but they are too slow in order to solve this image processing task, and one can approximate in several steps and run them several times on the image with different accuracies. So that's the idea. Okay, so now something about brain-computer interface. I said I wasn't working on that, and that's true. And essentially these guys have been working a lot on that topic. That's Gabriel Curio from the FU and Benjamin Blankertz and Klaus-Robert Müller, both from the Fraunhofer First in Berlin. Okay, so essentially the idea is that we somehow would like to transmit information from the brain into the computer, right? So, but there's some problem. The first problem maybe is that there are several different processes going on in the head. So, for instance, when you generate verbs, this region might be active. When you're speaking words, this region is active, and many other regions are there which all work like at the same time. So this is like a big mess of different sources, generating, transmitting some information, right? So, and you somehow have to separate out all these different sources and single out maybe just on this region or something like that. And this is essentially, it's called like the cocktail party problem. You have, for instance, one signal here and another signal here in some room, and you have two microphones. And each microphone observes a superposition of the different signals, like this one and this one here. And when you have enough microphones, then you can actually reconstruct what the signals actually transmitted. And I have an example, which is an acoustic demo. Okay, sorry. I don't know whether you can hear this. Okay, so I have like three sources. The first one is it's a big mess, so you essentially hear, don't hear anything. So all the other three sources, these are the mixtures already, right? So the three mixtures are pretty bad. So this is essentially the same. Okay, so, but there are algorithms actually to unmix those signals by enforcing independence between different sources via temporal decorrelation, but it doesn't matter. So, and what you get out in the end is like the unmixed signal, which looks like, which sounds like this. So this is like just a background noise. Okay, it's not so interesting. Come on. Okay, so this doesn't work. No. okay, so essentially there was a speaker and some music instrument, but I have it for you. It's this one here.
And taken by the light in her arms, I may without fail, at long and dear last, suffer the first...
And maybe you haven't heard this one, so that was also in the mixture. So, essentially, this kind of algorithms are applied to unmix the different signals which are emitted from the brain. And, oops... Okay. Okay. So now, so there's different things happening in the brain. So and The group in Berlin uses some electrodes on top of the head, like this one here contains 27 scalp electrodes and some other electrodes like EMG and EUG, but doesn't matter. So what we get out is essentially some time series at each of these different electrodes. So some electrophysical potential, which comes out here. So the red line is like just over time before actually something happens. And what they usually do is the subject imagines moving the left or the right hand, but it's actually not moving it, it's just imagining moving it, right? So the idea is that based on this imagination, one tries to classify whether he moves the left or the right hand. So, and that as early as possible. So like the imagined move time point is like here at zero, and one can actually classify that already before he actually imagined it. So that's like the setup. The human imagines different things, has his task, then we get the brain signals, so like the EEG signals, then they are pre-processed, like these source separation algorithm is run. We get some feature vectors out of this, and then we actually apply a classifier. And this is very similar to support vector machines, what's used there. And then we can classify whether the human thinks nothing, or thinks left, or thinks right. Okay? And I got a... I got a video for that. So that's Klaus-Robert Müller sitting in front of a computer, and he's playing brain pong. Okay, it's not perfect, but it already works pretty well. So here we have all the electrodes. So he's connected to the computer, and the computer now hears this bar, and he tries to move left or right this bar, right? So and all the support vector machine, we don't see that, right? So okay. So, so he's doing pretty well, not perfect though. So, for instance, now, so it was a bit late again. But, okay. So the the amount of information which can be transmitted by this computer brain interface at the moment is like 30 bits per minute. So maybe a mouse has maybe 300 bits per minute, okay? So like a computer mouse. But you don't need to do any invasive things, so it's not too bad, right? Okay, other questions for that? Yep.
Well, I have worked with systems for handicapped and for people that can't move anymore. And this is actually the fastest way I've ever seen some brain control a computer. So you already got the best system in the world, I think, for people that can't move their body. Are you planning to sell this system or make it available for handicapped people?
Yeah, so there's some collaboration with the Charité to do that. I'm not personally involved, but I know there are collaborations. So I don't know, these systems you're talking about were invasive or non-invasive?
No, things like detecting brain waves like you do mm-hmm. here, but this is actually the best one I've seen so far.
Mm, okay.
So it would be nice if you could get it out fast, because there are lots of people that could be helped.
Okay, yeah, maybe you should talk
good
about
work.
That. Mm-hmm. Good. Okay, so my main work at the moment is trying to understand the human genome and also other genomes. I mainly work on a small worm on it's called Sinohapditis elegans, and I try to find genes on the genomic DNA. So, for instance, that one here is a part of the DNA. This is one side, and this represents one gene. So a gene has a certain structure. There are exons and there are introns, and these introns are actually removed in the course of splicing, and in the very end one gets a protein out. Okay, so now there are different signals on the DNA which can one can detect, like this one here, that is the region where the translation starts, that's where the protein translation starts. Okay, and that always is some ATG here. There are other regions like the boundaries between exons and introns, and that always contains a GT, and the intron-exon boundary always contains an AG. But there are, of course, many AGs and many GTs and also many ATGs. So, and not every of these signal, every of these positions are actually translation initiation sites or splice sites. So now one task is to actually identify those sites. One work, which is a bit older, I did in 2000, I think, together with Alexander Zien and some other guys in Berlin, is trying to engineer a support vector kernel which is particularly well suited for recognizing translation initiation sites. So essentially what you do, you have your nucleotide sequence, you plug it into the SVM, and this SVM decides whether a certain ATG is a true translation initiation site or not. So for instance, this one here, so this one here is a false one, and this one is a true one. And how does this work? Essentially, we have a sequence like AT, which contains ATG, and we cut out, we actually consider all positions which contain this ATG. And then we cut out the ATG, get a new sequence which just contains 200 nucleotides, and then we put this sequence into a vector space. So if there's an A, then we put a 1 into a certain position. If there's C, we put a 1 in a different position, and so on. And this leads to a 1,000-dimensional space in this case. So, and then we can again use our support vector machine in order to classify true ATGs against all the other sequences.
What is N?
Pardon?
What is N?
N is like an unknown, where the sequence is unknown. So, yeah. Could also be filled up maybe with random letters. So what we get there is maybe we can classify them with around 85% correctly, which is not perfect. We are much better now, but that's why I got these slides here. Okay, some other problem is the problem of splice site recognition, but I don't want to go into detail here. That's some very recent work, and we can do very good on that. Okay, so the last one is this drug design cycle. I want to talk a bit more about that, a few minutes more. So you've seen these slides, and what usually happens is that we have a big library of different compounds, and we use the learning machine in order to classify whether it is most likely to be active or inactive. So, and the situation looks like this. So we have positive points here, negative points here, and a lot of unlabeled points in the middle. So we don't know the label yet. And essentially, we use support vector machine to classify these points and then to select unlabeled points, which should be next time used for wet lab verification. Okay? So, and just a few remarks on how these features are generated. Essentially, one has for every compound, one has a 3D structure, and somehow one aligns these structures and then compares it against a small library, and for every 3D position where some elements in this 3D structure match, one gets a bit switched on in a very long vector. So like each compound is described by 10 to the 5 different bits. Okay, so it's a quite high dimensional space. So, and what the people are then interested in is finding the compounds which are active as fast as possible. So I skip over that. So last slide. Some concluding remarks. So there are some computational challenges. Oops. Okay. So there are some computational challenges. The algorithms can work with maybe hundreds of thousands of examples. They usually need n squared to n to the cube operations. So that is usually not too bad. Even with a million examples, it might take maybe a day of computing time. So, but a million is really a lot, right? So with with 1,000 examples probably takes less than a minute. So usually you need to do some model parameter selection, and that is quite expensive. So what we need then is some computer clusters and some job scheduling system like PBS or Grid Engine. We often use MATLAB. It's commercial software package. We actually want to replace it by Python. We would need some help there. If you're interested in contributing, let me know. And okay, maybe finally I would like to say that machine learning is an exciting research area which involves computer science, statistics, and mathematics. It has a large number of present and also future applications. You have seen a few. It has some elegant underlying theory. You have not seen so much of that. And there are actually a lot of questions to study in machine learning. Actually, I started a new group in on computational biology in Tübingen, and when you are interested in this topic, let me know. Okay, thank you for your attention. Are there some more questions? No?